This is Liquidity Talks, a live stream and podcast series designed to share the latest trends and updates from the world of treasury, liquidity, and risk. Join us as we power up the liquidity conversation.
Hello, and welcome to our latest installment of Liquidity Talks live stream and podcast. I'm Neville Robertson, the CEO and founder of Planix, the market-leading fintech focused on treasury, liquidity, and risk. Our topic today is very topical indeed, and it's focused around artificial intelligence, or AI, and it's called Where Can AI Help in the World of Liquidity? Now, I'm joined today by our guest speaker, Nick Jepson. Many of you probably already know Nick. He stood in for me during the last podcast. Thank you very much, Nick. But I'm going to give the floor to you, Nick, to make an intro and tell us what you do.
Thank you, Neil. Yeah, so I'm Chief Revenue Officer at Planix. I've been working with Planix for just over 3 years. Prior to that, I was actually a client who selected Planix as part of a procurement process for a significant UK bank. And many, many years before that, I studied at Manchester University, did a master's. And AI was a large part of that. And then subsequently went on to work on one of the first commercial implementations of an expert system in the UK. So I've always had a bit of an interest in AI, and I see lots of opportunities to continue to expand its use for our client base and beyond.
Thanks, thanks very much, Nick. Now, football-wise, just carry on this theme, Nick, is actually supports Wolves. For those of you who don't know, that's Wolverhampton Wanderers. And I know what you're thinking. Who are they? Nick, I was wondering, is that a birthright or some output for some weird AI program there is out there? I won't let you comment on that. Right. The podcast today is based on a blog. We're going to get that posted in the comments section so you can see that and you can read that at your own leisure. But Nick, look, I guess where to start this podcast, let's talk about AI. And I guess, you know, what does it mean? What does it mean in the industry? What does it mean to you? What is it in your eyes?
Okay, so if I go back to, I'll go back to the academic stage. I mean, what does it mean? So the very early origins of artificial intelligence are in the sort of late 1940s, 1950s, thereabouts. And there was a chap called Alan Turing, who probably many of you have heard the name, and a movie about him called The Imitation Game. And that came about, the title is quite relevant because Turing is famous for many things, but one of which was the Turing test, or still is the Turing test, which is a measure of whether a machine is able to demonstrate intelligent behavior equivalent to a human. And that's obviously the imitation of a human with a machine. Have we managed to achieve that test in all the 70-odd years since that point? No. We can get pretty close to it now with technology, but we haven't got there. But there have been a number of stages of evolution of AI over that period from that point. Many of them are huge leaps forward, then limited by the available technology, the capability of the hardware, the speed, the storage capacity. If you think back to the very early days, those have been to a museum of computing, we'll know that the storage was very small, the cost of the processing was very large. And I think there was some chap from IBM who said he couldn't see a use for more than two or three of these computer things anywhere in the world ever back then. But a lot of this comes from an exercise that was done in the US back in the 1950s called the Logic Theorist. And this was around trying to find a way of using computing to prove logic problems, the solutions to logic problems. And very quickly, they developed a mechanism of proving in a better way than your expert humans could. So that got people thinking that they could actually start making significant progress in the area of artificial intelligence. And it moved on from there into machine learning, which is really just around understanding more about the problem set. Then the 90s really lurched forward with things like IBM's Big Blue, which was a combination of deep learning, but huge processing power in order to beat Garry Kasparov, the world chess champion at the time, something that was going to be done. And it's taken 20 years since that point for the next human-computer challenge to be beaten, which is the game called Go. I don't know whether you might be familiar with it, but there's a really complicated strategy game called Go. Makes chess look simple. And it's taken until the last 4 or 5 years for a human to be beaten at that, or the world champion human, should we say, to be beaten at that by a machine. The neural networks are an interesting thing because they started in the late 70s, early 80s. They're still a key component of the new technologies that are being used now. But they're not really, they weren't really that much in use in banking. The thing that banks have really picked up and using in the last few years is, it's probably the last 15 years, it's robotic process automation, so RPA. And this is replacement of processing within standard end-to-end business processes. Parts of those processes are picked up by robots on behalf of people. So what we've seen is a change from the AI tool basically providing a component of the processing activity to now starting to get to the point where they and being effectively autopilot to moving on to being in co-pilot mode, working with humans to actually manage to deliver solutions in banking and elsewhere. And the sudden emergence of ChatGPT causes a whole range of challenges across the industry. And we'll come on to a few of those in a minute.
So, Nick, I think you're saying AI has been around for a long, long time, but really with the onset of the cloud, the access to almost an infinite compute power, now we've got that processing to be our power to be able to bring it to life and use in real time examples such as financial services and liquidity, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Good. So look, I get the excitement out there. It's literally everywhere you turn. AI, machine learning. What do you think it means for implementation within financial services and obviously liquidity?
I think there's a couple of aspects to that. The first one is it's probably worth just understanding a little bit more. I've talked about this in the history of it, a little bit more about what these GPTs are and how they work. Probably many people might not even know what it means, but GPT is generative pre-trained model, the GPT bit. And what that implies is that you pre-train the tool to understand the sequence of logical sequences of words, which basically, when it's fed into the tool, get turned into things called tokens. So to train GPT-3, for example, 560 gigabytes worth of the internet was consumed. So that's all sorts of things from encyclopedias to Wikipedia to news channels to you name it, articles, whatever, consumed and read. And what the tool does is it breaks it down word by word, and in some cases, if they're long words, into subcomponents, turns them into tokens, and then stages them in this large language model that allows you to understand the likely relationship between words. And it does that repeatedly and repeatedly and repeatedly, and it keeps going and keeps going until it's consumed all of the data and worked out the initial positioning and ranking. And what I mean by that is every token will have a relationship coefficient with other tokens in some respects. And then you carry on training it more and more, asking questions, maybe asking the same question a couple of times to see whether it comes up with the same answers. And if it doesn't, what you do is you typically get you present both answers to a human, and you get the human to select which one is the most relevant. And then you'll feed that back in, and it will continue to learn from there. And once you got to ChatGPT-3 onwards, you've got to the point where it's actually starting to learn about learning. So that's quite a big step forward. It's doing learning in its own right. It learns from the questions you asked, whereas the early GPTs didn't really do so much of that. There's a few other bits of interesting terminology around this as well, because you go, well, actually, how does that work? So you've got this large language model, and what you've got to do is then ask questions of it. And the chat bit is really important, because bringing natural language questioning to it has made it hugely more powerful and usable by anybody. I've got my kids using it as part, you know, not for their homework, of course, but, you know, I've got everybody you see, you know, or talk to most of them have probably had a go at writing queries on it. And see,
it's like having a chat like this, right? It's like, exactly. I ask you something, I get an answer back. And
I mean, I've tried it. I write blogs on various topics. So I asked ChatGPT to give me some thoughts about the main risks in liquidity and align them with famous scientists and their greatest discoveries. And I ended up with one of them coming back being Stephen Hawking and the black hole of liquidity. And I thought, you know, if it's clever enough to come back with an answer like that, that's pretty impressive.
Hopefully that was liquidity in our context, right?
it was, yes. Interesting. And moving on to other stuff, what you need is once we've got below the language interaction, you then have a small code set. It's really quite a small code set that actually then goes and draws on the various tokens that have been stored that relate to words or parts of words within this large language model. And that's what's the real development is the cleverness of the way in which and the difference between each of the tools that are out there, like Grok and OpenAI and so on, they're all based on different code sets, different technologies, different approaches, broadly similar. But of course, Elon has set up Grok, his own AI tool, as being slightly more mischievous, I think would be the right way of describing it. Whereas if you want to actually use OpenAI, ChatGPT, and basically ask questions and get a more random response, a more esoteric response, you do something that's called turn up the temperature. And temperature is the degree of randomness in the response, and it applies then to the coefficients and so on and so forth. But all of that's just terminology. What it does is it provides you along the time with some pretty clever and very quick output to something that might have taken you quite a bit of time to do otherwise. What you've got to watch out for, though, is this wonderful terminology called hallucinations as well, where it comes up with an answer that's not based on data or on the rules that you apply. And occasionally they do that, which is another reason why you still need to have experts involved, not just in AI, but also experts that can check the outputs to make sure that they are sensible.
Got it. So look, Nick, I get the kind of the technical opportunities are out there. They're impressive. What else do you need to think through? And I'm thinking here about organizational culture, controls, maybe cost. What's your views on those things?
Well, let's pick up cost, because everybody's cost conscious these days. Yeah. So cost is probably the most important one to consider at the very start of this. Cost for AI and AI-capable hardware 20, 30 years ago would have been prohibitive for most organizations. It certainly wouldn't be something that you'd be able to do on your phone. The cost of GPT services right now is very low. And one of the great things about GPTs is you could actually set up your own version of them. So you can partition the data set away from the general GPT knowledge base. So you can keep proprietary information to yourselves largely. And operate those for very low cost, because the processing power and everything else is so comparatively cheap nowadays. So I don't think cost is actually the big barrier. I think the challenges are really, let's start with culture. Culture is the bit, one of the biggest challenges. I mean, having worked in banking for 20 odd years, I know that pre-COVID, trying to get any information out of a bank and take it home to work on it was very difficult. There were so many rules and constraints around that. And instantaneously, we managed to fix that when lockdowns happened. We had to. There was no choice. So I think there are ways in which we can fix the issues and concerns from a cultural and control perspective for this technology as well. But As a naturally conservative part of the business enterprise, it's really important to try and keep focus on what can be done and operating within commercial and regulatory constraints, but not constraining it so much that you don't actually step forward and take advantage of this at all. I think. That limitation focus in the risk aversion that is in many organizations, sometimes clustered in particular parts of the organizations, you need to work with these, they need to embrace this change, and that requires putting effort in to help them adapt and modify their culture accordingly. Led from the top, of course. Culture has to work from top to bottom. It can be influenced from the bottom, but it has to be led from the top. And with the excitement that I hear from board members that are talking about how do we use AI, there's the excitement there. I don't necessarily think they understand sufficiently what the considerations are that they need to have and what the implications might be as well. So when we come to implications, the next consideration is really around controls. Now, banking. We're all familiar with the three lines of defense. The first line being the people who actually do the day-to-day business, and then you've got your risks, and then you've got your audits, and so on and so forth levels. And you've got to work out how your AI solution, such that it is, or AI use, fits into that three lines of defense. So you still need to have governance where, certainly in the short term, you've got a human who's a sort of co-pilot for the AI and will check the outcome. You also need to make sure that at the second layer of defense, when you're trying to get an explanation of why the AI tool came out with the outcome it did, because there's this concept of an explain function, you need to be able to understand what data was put in, what rules it applied, what sequence of rules, and therefore how the outcome was reached. So at one of the lines of defense, certainly the second line, you'd need to be able to understand that from an explain perspective. You can't have black boxes because it's just not something that people are comfortable with. And certainly where you've got a whole load of regulatory requirements around, you need to be able to, when asked to, explain how decisions were made.
Nick, I was just thinking then, from a regulatory point of view, any input, feedback from the regulator on this in terms of, are they happy with it? Are they going to focus on the explain piece? Because they'll have to know the origins of where this came from. So any comment from them yet on this?
Don't see much comment at all, really. I think I think there is a degree to which it is reasonable for the regulator to assume in this case that whilst the technology is rushing forward, the existing regulations are appropriate, because the regulatory controls and the regulatory requirements that there are, in banking generally, require a single point of responsibility, a board member who is responsible for regulatory compliance across the entire organization. It used to be that that could be collective and therefore got muddled up. But now it's a single point of responsibility. So ultimately, the regulator has someone to go after if there's a problem, if there's inappropriate use of AI, if there's inappropriate outcomes for customers. There is a single point that you can go to. And then from there, you get delegated authorities and responsibilities down to the individuals. But you can't, you can't jail an AI. You can't ban it from working for the next few years. You can't fine it, really, because it's pointless. At the moment, it doesn't have feelings, so it's not going to get upset necessarily. I'm not saying that won't change, but at the moment, it hasn't got feelings. You can't really apply sanctions on it. There's no naughty step on which to sit it. So basically, you've got to hold a human accountable.
Right, got it. So look, we've got AI, financial services, liquidity. What would you focus on? So there's many, many things. It's just twirling through my head there about what you could do, but what would you focus on first? What are the few areas that you would think about?
In terms of actually using AI for liquidity purposes,
So
the main one to start with would probably the call out would be forecasting. I mean, we've got some really interesting examples that we're seeing you can do everything from forecast the likelihood of payments to being received that day based on the pattern of previous activities from a correspondent or a counterparty, we're working with a large partner, as you're aware, with them, looking at multiple years worth of faster payment history, looking at what that might mean, and getting some substantially better results than we thought we might. Very, very accurate, way above what I would have thought was expected. particularly given not necessarily the randomness, but the many other factors that can impact spending, and all sorts of other things that can impact, you know, what happens on a given day or in a particular period of time. So it's really, really very impressive. And then when you get past the forecasting component for the payment schemes, you can actually sort of look at individual people using, or groups of individuals use, and organizations and their cash balances and the activities that they take with those. You know, you can be fairly certain that when it comes to tax day at the end of January in the UK, there'll be large exits of funds from personal accounts going flying across to Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. And we're all a little sad to see those go, of course, but you know, Black Friday isn't the day that we see large amounts moving. And obviously, when it comes to inbound, last Friday of the month, last Thursday of the month, last day of the month, depending on when payrolls are run. So you can start to build up a much better sense of when you're going to get that money in. That's the individuals. So you've then got to take that and project that onto corporates. And doing so requires a degree more insight and intelligence than maybe some of the tools that we have around right now. So AI is a really good opportunity to look at those problems.
Yeah, I was just thinking then about, you know, this with this partner of ours. I was amazed at the results, right? Using AI to forecast the liquidity uses in a payment scheme is great, but the fit, it was fitted like a glove, right? But I'm presuming underpinning all a regulator and a consumer customer ultimately will want to know the explainability of it. Where did it come from? How did you get that result? Because you don't want adverse effects where the outcome is you're hallucinating around it. You get an answer that's left field because it needs to be contained in a corridor, right, of that forecast.
Yeah, and when it comes to numerical outcomes, quite frequently the best treatment is to run the same question a number of times to see whether you've got a degree of randomness, what spread there is, whether you've got any outlying items, or whether you've got a fairly good clustering around a particular point. You know, the good old bell curve serves well when it comes to this sort of thing. If you can run things quickly and fast enough, and often enough, then you can get a fairly good sense of, you know, of what the most likely outcome is. Although obviously, if you've got to consider things like fairness towards customers and clients, then the most common outcome might not necessarily be the fairest. So you then have the challenges around, you know, needing to have some human interaction to look at that as well. But no, there's some really good opportunities around that.
And what about the ethical side of this? So the ethical considerations about using AI, not just in financial services, but just more broadly.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you take the medical profession, where they're already using quite a lot of AI, you do want a human at the end of the decision process as to whether to turn off the machines, don't you? If you're in intensive care, you want to make sure that someone is looking out for you in that respect. It can support the process, just like we were talking about earlier. It supports the process. It needs to have explainability in there, but actually, some of the clever uses, staying in the field of medicine, some of the really clever uses are in the world of diagnostics and being able to repeatedly analyze MRI scans, for example, and identify anomalies far more accurately than humans can on a repeatable basis, because, you know, obviously we have limited attention spans, and the volumes that need of data that need to be sifted through, it's relatively simple to miss things if you're whereas a machine you would hope is relatively repeatable and going to be able to deal with that well. The ethical question, though, is really, should we? It's not can we?
Yeah.
Because I think we've got past the point of can we. We're pretty much, we can do anything almost without limits now, given the power of the tools that we've now got. The question is, should we? And that's where you need to make sure that you've got a degree of human involvement in the process chain. And the other thing that you've got to be very careful of is whether or not your tool has got ethical bias built into it. So this is around it comes back to the educational side and the testing side. So not just explain, which says how it did it, but if you take GPT, for example, there are a couple of organizations refuse to allow their data to be used in the base data set. So those organizations have no representation as part of the knowledge base, shall we call it, from which ChatGPT operates. One of them was a relatively right-wing media organization in the UK. They declined to participate. So does that skew the outcome? It's considerations like that need to be brought in mind. You also need to make sure that the people who've written the code that controls how you prioritize and determine which token, which outputs are preferred from the tokens that are used. You also need to make sure that when the testing and training is done, that's done from an ethically appropriate perspective, that you have appropriate challenges on the ways in which that were done. But then again, I mean, you'd have to do that with humans as well. That's one of the reasons why you have the three lines of defense. You have four eyes control checks, because you need to make sure that at least another person involved, ideally someone abstracted from that area and not responsible for that person, but from a different team, a peer of some sorts or whatever, can challenge whether that is an appropriate action to take. And it's those things that still need to happen as well. Otherwise, you can't take the humans out of the machine completely just yet.
Yeah, and Nick, I've also heard that schools are now using ChatGPT to check whether or not ChatGPT was used in homework. So it's actually trying to self-mark itself. But we have a question here. We haven't got much time left, but I will ask this question from Nick Appleby. Nick, with AI, is there such thing as too much information, data, and different views to obtain a meaningful outcome? And a comment I would add to that is, to get meaningful output of the way we're using it in payment systems, we probably need at least 2 up to 3 years of data. So what's your view on the level of input you need to get a meaningful output?
With the technology capabilities that we've got right now, there's so much capacity in these tools to put a large amount of information in a large language model. We're talking about billions of tokens, for example, when I talked about 560 gigabytes worth of data being trawled, text being internet information being trawled. That's resulted in, I think, something of the order of half a trillion tokens. As you scale up from that, it will slow down, because we're again approaching the point where there's probably another technological advance needed to be able to do the next level worth of information. But half a trillion tokens is plenty to do, virtually everything you can think of. I struggle to think of a use case that would need more than that. From a forecasting perspective, 2, 3, 4, 5 years worth of time is all I'd normally expect to see. The only exception they might see to that is where you've got people like regulators or people looking for financial crime might want to look across an even longer duration to see patterns of behavior. So you can see some situations where there might in extremis be more than that, but I think be pretty rare. I think the size of the GPT tools and the AI tools around right now, and the availability of them, is such that I don't think many of us are going to find a reason to need to go bigger for a long time to come.
And Nick, do you ever see AI taking over the industry, so it runs financial services for us and everything's perfect and there's never any problems? Do you think we'll ever get to that stage?
I wrote a paper 20 years ago called The Virtual Bank, which actually talked about basically creating banks from the smallest unique sales point possible, and then everything else being provided by common service provision, much of which could probably be done with AI in time. But I think you've still got those three lines of defense and you still need the humans in yeah. there to check and balance. Certainly until such point as you've got maybe the concept of rival AIs checking up on each other. And as long as they've been promised to gang together, at which point we start getting a bit Terminator.
We do indeed.
No, I don't think for a while to come.
Fascinating. Well, look, we're running out of time, unfortunately, Nick. I know we could talk about that for many, many hours, but thank you very, very much for joining us today and sharing your views. Happy holidays. My name's Neville Roberts. Thank you for tuning in and goodbye.
You've been listening to Liquidity Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to stay updated on the latest developments and industry opinion from the world of treasury, liquidity and risk.